Blog Talk Radio.
Good Saturday to you. This is Cliff, your host, and welcome to, yes, it is, another edition of Earth Ancients. It's Earth Ancients, startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. That was the title that I came up with a couple of years ago, and it was really based on a book that I was writing where I was going to different parts of the world and had done enough research on Central America and knew that there were civilizations that had actually predated both the Maya, Aztec, Olmec. And yet we don't hear about these earlier civilizations. And Earth Ancients is all about discovering, understanding the impact of these earlier civilizations and revealing as much as we can about them. So bits and pieces, that's what we're all about. I think you figured that out by now if you've been with us for at least a few months. There's a lot to discuss this week. The first thing I want to talk about is Zechariah Sitchin's book, The Anunnaki Chronicles, is actually officially out now, and I got my first copy. And I've been looking at the first few chapters, and it's really, really a primer for his work. The 12th Planet came out about 30 years ago, 25 years ago, actually. And this, it's called The Anunnaki Chronicles, a Zechariah Sitchin Reader, includes never-before-published writings edited by Janet Sitchin. We had Janet on the program, and Janet went over her contributions. And the thing that makes this a really good book, a primer, actually, a prelude to his work, Zechariah Sitchin, is that it discusses his research, how he came about with his idea for these books, the Earth Chronicles, and it actually shows his thought process leading up to the writing of each book, and has diagrams, has notes, has lecture transcriptions from audios. And I really suggest that everyone, if you're a Sitchin fan and want to know about that point of view, of course, remember his point of view is that aliens came down 400,000 years ago and created an atom and so on and so forth. I am on the fence with that, but some of the data in terms of these ancient ruins is pretty interesting. Mike Berra, our author who's been on our program before, says, Janet Sitchin's collection of the Anunnaki Chronicles is a worthy successor to her uncle Zechariah Sitchin's life work. It expands and enhances our understanding of who the Anunnaki were, why they came here, and why they may someday return. We all know Mike Berra. Mike's the author of Ancient Aliens on Mars. Don't like that title, but the books are really good. But anyhow, what's happened is the publishers contacted me, and in a couple of weeks, we're going to do a sponsorship for Inner Traditions, the sole publisher of the Zechariah Sitchin collections of books, and specifically this book, The Anunnaki Chronicle. And we're going to run, excerpts from the Janet Sitchin interview, and also make available a discounted link to a discounted book, this Anunnaki Chronicle, so you can purchase it. So look for that. That's going to be October 17th is the kickoff, and we're probably going to run it for the rest of the month, a special sponsorship in honor of this new book. Now, I also want to say that not only is the 17th of October going to be the kickoff for this new Sitchin book, but in honor of the giant Nephilim, who were described in the Bible as these giant human beings or humanoids, we're going to have a world-class program on ancient giants. It's going to be a panel discussion from some of the foremost authorities around the world. People will be calling in, and I'm going to do my best to make it a live event. I'm not going to give out the names of the individuals, but just be known that each of the individuals on the panel will be an expert in their own right. And there'll be four people, four noted authors, one maybe who's up and coming, but these are people that you've known about, you've read their works, and it's Ancient Giants Around the World. It's a panel discussion I'll be moderating, and look forward to it. Saturday, October 17th, right here on Earth Ancients Radio. That's going to kind of kick off the Sitchin, the program there. So look forward to seeing that. Well, what happened here with this Mars disclosure we talked about last week? Really was kind of a joke in a way, claiming that they had discovered water, rivers. Possible rivers still flowing. Makes that kind of strange, though, is we have evidence from scientists. Let's go back to last week. Dr. John Brandenburg, who has identified the oceans of Mars. The oceans of Mars. And so here's NASA saying, oh, we've identified water on the planet. Here's some rivers. I mean, big deal. I mean, really. Who gives a damn? Tell us, show us the archaeology. Show us the ruins. I mean, there's a group of scientists who have shown us that there are ruins of an ancient civilization on the planet. Why do they keep suppressing this knowledge? Brandenburg published his papers. He gave out the information to a body of scientists of two horrific nuclear explosions millions of years ago, tens of millions of years ago, that literally wiped the planet clean of any life forms and was very well the reason, probably the reason that the atmosphere was blown apart and the surface of the planet was never the same. Why we don't hear more about this is just mind-boggling. It's like, I mean, why do we have to have games around Mars, you know? I was thinking about this the other day. Are there any rovers on our own moon? Are there any research programs going on? No. I think there's maybe one or two satellites occasionally are flying around, but does the United States have any serious investment in the moon? No. Our serious investment is on Mars. We're talking billions and billions of dollars on satellite technology, two rovers, and now they are planning a manned mission. I mean, what is up with that? You know, I mean, really, why bother? Why bother if there's not something there to uncover, if there's not something there to show? I don't get it. And these joke announcements. I really wish somebody would. I'd love to have Brandenburg stand in the audience when the NASA groups like they're going, hey, we found water, we found rivers. Excuse me, there's ruins of ancient civilizations there. Have you looked at those? Oh, what about the nuclear explosions that wipe the planet clean of any life forms. Have you checked out the data on that? We don't hear NASA talking about those things. I don't get it. Why does it have to be independent researchers that find this stuff and disclose it? You know, I don't get it. There's something totally up with that. It's like they want you to follow their agenda. And if you cannot follow their agenda, then it shouldn't be of interest to you. It's like, God, this is stupid. It just drives me nuts. So anyhow, water on Mars turned out to be a joke. I was hoping for some kind of a disclosure that was unique. I don't know. I guess I'm asking for too much when I think that they're going to say, hey, we found some unusual structures that look like archaeology. Okay, so it's not going to happen right now. Okay. All right. Well, I'll keep doing my part. Travel news, tour news. Ancient Mysteries International has updated their information regarding this Ganoon Penang tour. Of course, you guys know Danny Hillman, who we had on the show, is the one who has been excavating this amazing pyramid dated, currently dated at 23,000 years old, but I don't know. It's probably going to go further back than just that. But we have Bruce Cunningham on the show. He's going to give us a quick update and some really cool news about some new pricing. So, hey, Bruce, how are you this morning?
Oh, hey, Cliff. Very good.
Okay, so what do you got for us? What's going on with this tour?
Okay, basically, because of some problems I had with the agency in Jakarta, I had to reschedule the bulk of the Java tour for next year, probably in the fall. But we are all still going to have a conference in Jakarta with Dr. Carmen Bolter and Dr. Danny Hillman. And then we are still going to Gunung Padang, maybe 2 days instead of just one. So the tour basically has been changed to just Gunung Padang and the conference. But for that, of the people who want to travel, I'm going to have a price of $599 all-inclusive. I mean, it's only going to be probably 4 or 5 days, but the people that come all the way to Java from far away still have the opportunity to go to some of these other sites that we will do our best to help facilitate if they wish to go to
Okay, so what are the dates, the new dates now? What are the new dates?
Okay, still the same would be December or November 30th to December 4th.
December 4th. So you're actually taking off 2 days. So it's what, it's $599? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, basically, because you know, we don't have the airplanes and the different buses, and you know, we cut off most of the expense of the tour. So make it presentable to those who would like to, you know, travel and see Gunung Padang with Dr. Bolter and Dr. Hillman their guides and hosts.
Okay, and so they can get more information by going to website ancientmysteriesinternational.net, N-E-T, not .com, .net, or they can call you at 260-417-8548. And I guess it's a highlighted trip, mostly focused on the main pyramid and that surrounding area, plus a conference. So it's a 4-day program now. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, about 5 days, I guess. 4 or 5 days.
About 5 days.
I mean, if they come in early, we'll take care of them. You know, if they come in, because I will be here that weekend. I will be on the 28th of November. I will be in Jakarta.
Okay. So, cool.
Basically, they can also email me at info@ancientmysteriesinternational.net. And any questions that they would have, and we can just communicate at that point.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, it's not cool that you, it's not cool, but I mean, it's too bad that you didn't have the full part of the tour. But for me, the cherry of that whole tour was the Ganoon Penang pyramid tour with Dr. Hillman, because and you're going to be 2 days there rather than one. So that's really pretty nice. So that's cool. All right. Well,
yeah.
Hey, we'll probably have you on a couple more times just to kind of see what the situation is. Anything else?
Just that we have got an Angkor Wat tour going on with Priya Vihir that is mentioned in Graham Hancock's new book for March 14th through the 20th next year. And there will be more information on that very soon.
Okay, fantastic. All right, hey, I'm still hoping to get some kind of a live feed or some maybe a recording of some of that information on that conference that you guys have in December.
Oh, for sure. For sure, because Jakarta will have a very good signal. That should be no problem at all.
All right. Hey, that'll be great. All right, Bruce, thanks. And look forward to hearing more about that. Be sure to go to that website. The phone number again is 260-417-8548, and they will give you more information if you need it. Okay, thanks, Bruce. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye, Cliff.
All right, Bruce Cunningham with Ancient Mysteries International. That's, boy, $599. God. All you got to do is get yourself over there on your plane and you're set. All right. Today, we're introducing a new book, Resilience from the Heart, The Power to Thrive in Life's Extremes, with Greg Braden. Greg is, I consider him a sage. He is a scientist, but has also looked into ancient wisdom, traveled the world, has been to Tibet. And I recorded this yesterday with him. It's shorter than I had hoped, but he is extremely in demand right now. You really need to listen to what he has to say about current events and how they relate to ancient past history. I am somebody who really believes in past wisdom kind of coming up, present cyclic energetics, things that have happened in the past renewing themselves. So this is about an hour, and I think you'll like it, and I'll come on after when it's done and we'll follow up.
Well, my guest today is Greg Braden. Greg is the New York Times bestselling author and the 2015 Templeton Award nominee, and he's internationally renowned as a pioneer in bridging science and indigenous knowledge to create real-world situations for today. Now, Greg is somewhat of a prolific writer. I'm going to read off a few books you may have read or have heard about. The most well-known is The Turning Point. He also wrote Fractal Time, The God Code, and then The Divine Matrix. And this new book is the Resilience from the Heart, The Power to Thrive in Life's Extremes. Greg, welcome to the program.
Well, Cliff, first I just want to tell you, thank you so much for inviting me on the program. I'm absolutely thrilled to be with you today. I'm thrilled to be with our audience today and all the people that listen through the podcast on whatever days they do listen.
Yeah.
There's just so much that we could talk about. There's so many different places we could go with this material today. And I'm excited just to cover anything. I'm going to follow your lead. And as I mentioned earlier, I think my sense is our time's going to go by very, very quickly today. This is fascinating. It's exciting. It's fascinating.
Well, this book is very interesting, and you talk quite a bit about big changes happening. Mm-hmm. What can you give us an overview for these, as you call them, shifts that we can identify?
Yeah, you know, and I'm happy that we're beginning with this question, because the book was written about our ability to embrace change and to do so in a healthy way, as individuals and as families, as communities, and even between nations. But the change that I'm talking about here, Cliff, it's we don't live our lives in a vacuum. So while change can be about new jobs, new careers, new relationships, or the loss of all of those things, and those are all important in our lives, there's an even larger systemic change that is sweeping our planet today. And I think even the skeptics in the past who used to shun the idea, you know, change, what change? Mm-hmm. I think even they are now beginning to ask a question, what in the world is going on? So I'll begin with the fact that the best minds of our time are telling us now that we're living what they call a time of extremes. And it doesn't mean that only bad things are happening, as a lot of people like to suggest, or even good things, for that matter. What it means, these extremes, it means big things are happening in the world, big changes in the world, and because we can no longer separate the big world out there from what happens in our everyday lives, we are feeling the effects of these changes. And the changes are covering a lot of ground. And people say to me, you know, what's causing the changes? And what I can say at a very high level, and due to the considerations for our time today, I mean, we could go as deep as we wanted to go into this, but what's happening now that makes our lifetime so very different from those of our parents or our grandparents or even 200-300 years ago is that we're living the convergence of three cycles that we have never seen in our lifetimes. 5,000 years ago was the last time this happened. And these are cycles, number one, of climate change, the cyclic nature of the climate change. And as a degree geologist, an earth scientist, I can tell you I'd love to talk about that all day long.
Yeah.
The second is the cycles of economic change that are sweeping the earth. And when people hear about economies, they think money automatically. And I have to say that while an economy can be about money, it doesn't have to be. Very successful economies have existed without money, but it's about people. Cliff, it's about us and the way that we share the vital resources that we need for our everyday lives and how we go about dealing with those resources when they become scarce or when our conditions of our lives change. And the third cycle, is one that people rarely have heard of in the modern world. It is a cycle of conflict. They are called war cycles or conflict cycles.
Mm-hmm.
Competition and conflict is a human experience, and because we are governed by natural laws and natural rhythms of nature, there are actually cyclic rhythms of conflict. That some of them are short-term, some of them are long-term, nested cycles within cycles. And we are right in the middle of a conflict cycle right now. It began in 2014, it peaks in 2017, and if you look at the conditions of the world today, you can see there is a momentum toward conflict. It doesn't mean we must have war. It means that we're vulnerable, we're susceptible to that. So when I say we're living a time of extremes, just to clarify, we are living this rare, precious window of time when three big cycles, climate, economy, and conflict, are all converging in our lifetimes. And I think it's fair to say for our listeners that our world is changing in ways, first, that we have never seen. So that means we don't have any good blueprints to really tell us, or guidebooks to tell us how to navigate through these changes. And it means also that our lives are changing very, very quickly. And I'm not going to say it's right, wrong, good, or bad. I'm going to say we're not used to it. Our lives are changing in ways that we're simply not used to. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line to all of this that lays the foundation for everything we'll do in this conversation is that it means we've got to think and live differently, more so now than at any time in the past. Fortunately, the science, the best science of the 20th and now the 21st centuries, they give us the reasons to think and live differently, because the science, the pure science, not the science that's been hijacked by corporations or politicians or religions, there's a separate story there, but the pure science that actually is telling us in very clear terms, answering some of the biggest questions that we could ever ask: who are we, where do we come from, how do we make things better for ourselves, what is our relationship to our bodies, what is our relationship to the past, what is this fundamental rule of nature? Those are all questions that help us to navigate these times of extremes.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, when I wrote the most recent book, is called Resilience from the Heart, The Power to Thrive in Life's Extremes, my through line is simply this, Cliff: the better we know ourselves and our relationship to the world, the better equipped we are to embrace whatever change life brings to our doorstep in a healthy way. So we don't know what's going to happen, and we cannot possibly prepare for every eventuality. However, my sense is that as we honor the deepest truths of us and our relationship to our bodies, one another, and the world, by doing so, we are equipped to embrace this change, not just, and this is important, not just to survive, but to thrive in a new normal that now is bathing this world, a new normal that looks very, very different than what we've been led to believe in the past. So that's a long answer to a short question, and I want to lay all that out so we can tie into it as we go through our program today.
Now, you're noted for capturing and following traditions of Native cultures, ancient or no longer used cultural insights. Would you say that you're tapping into a little bit of this in your insight with the science to tell us that, look, it's my feeling that we have to look at these changes from more of a holistic point of view, or is it more that, hey, there's problems coming up, be ready for them?
Here's the thing. My work is based on peer-reviewed science, and that is very different than pop science that pops up, you know, on the internet or on the YouTube video. Anybody can write anything and put it on the internet these days. We know that. Mm-hmm. It's been important for me to honor myself and my audiences. And I have to say, this is the 30th year now. I'm celebrating my 30th year anniversary of sharing this information in one form or another. The first program was in 1986, so 2016 will be this 30 years.
Okay.
And what I've found is simply this. We owe it to ourselves to be truthful, honest, and factual. How can we possibly be resilient and embrace change in a healthy way if we are not honest with ourselves about what that change means? So for me, my path has been to go to the places in the world that are least disturbed by modern society. Because my sense is that is where our information is most intact. And that journey has led me to the things that you're talking about. It's led me into some of the most isolated, remote, pristine, magnificent, beautiful places remaining on the earth today, the monasteries, the monks and the nuns on the highlands of central China and Tibet, and then the Andes Mountains of Bolivia and Peru, and all through Nepal and India and the American desert southwest, among other places. So it is in looking for the most intact information that I've also come to know the people that live the wisdom that they have preserved in their cultures. Mm-hmm. And it's in that wisdom that we find a story. And it is a story of us, of our global family, our origins, our history, our destiny, our fate. And interestingly, while that story is not scientific, and I'm going to say that very clearly, Cliff, what I learned from the indigenous people, it's not based in science. However, for 5,000 years, these people, our ancestors, they have used this story to help their lives work, to help them create better lives for themselves, their families, their communities. And now that science, which is only about 300 years old, science is a relatively young way of thinking about ourselves and our relationship to the world. Science only 300 years old, and in many places now, the science of today parallels that indigenous wisdom. It actually supports what our ancestors were saying to us, not every iota of everything that they were saying, but the general themes, the theme that we are connected to ourselves, that we are deeply connected to our bodies, that's a theme that's reflected in the new book, the theme that we are deeply connected to the earth. The theme that we live in a cyclic civilization based upon the cycles are driven by changes, vast changes in our solar system that change the way we live, where we grow our food, how we can grow our food. And as technologically advanced as we believe we are today, we are still influenced by those cycles. It just happens in different ways. So I think it's important, if we're going to be honest with ourselves, and this, I think, is where the mainstream has really dropped the ball. If we're going to be honest with ourselves about what's happening in the world today, we owe it to ourselves to be honest, truthful, factual, look at the big picture, and then where we fit into that picture, whereas the mainstream media typically focuses on one isolated issue. They'll say, for example, if we can just roll back the levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, for example, the climate's going to go back the way it used to be and everything's going to be okay. Or if we can roll back the level of debt in the world, the level of debt in the sovereign nations, that the economies are going to go back to what we're used to. What they are missing is that the world they're talking about going back to no longer exists. That world is gone. And we're living in a new normal. And these symptoms that they're talking about are just that. They are symptoms of a greater systemic change. That there is, and I have to say, there is definitely a reluctance to acknowledge this. And in many cases, there's a flat-out resistance to acknowledge it, even though the data, the pure science, is very, very clear. That science has been hijacked by people with agendas, political, religious, corporate agendas. And it's happening on all sides. And for me, because I'm saying this, I have to be very clear. It's not about making anyone right or anyone wrong or judging anyone as good or bad. I think we're outgrowing all of that. If we're going to be serious, if we're going to be real about what's happening, we've got to be honest with ourselves. And the science helps us to do that, and I've laid that out in I've written 10 books in the last 12 years, and every one of those books identifies one facet of the kind of changes we're talking about. The newest book now identifies how we can embrace extraordinary capabilities that have been with us from the time of our origin. How can we embrace those to deal with the change? And in doing so, we're opening the doors to mystical traditions and things that are very seldom talked about in the mainstream. So I
want to get into the book here in a second. I want to just ask you, do you believe that we are in a cyclic period where we're living the existence from maybe a previous civilization went through, and maybe that previous civilization, as more and more science is showing us, went through a catastrophic event, basically wiped the surface of the planet clean of their existence except for their ruins. But do you think that there's something about a possible cyclic nature that we're reliving, and maybe some of these native elders are providing us with some hints of how to get through this?
Yeah, absolutely. We're always in a cycle of some kind. The question is, do we know what cycle we're living in, and do we know our place in the cycle? And for me, this has been very important. I'll just tell you, when I was in school, I went to high school back in the 60s and 70s, and I remember our history professor drew a map on the chalkboard, and it's a map that largely is still used today. Believe it or not, Cliff, after all these years, the map suggests that civilization, modern what we call civilization today, it actually began about 5,000. Or maybe 5,500 years ago in ancient Sumeria. And everything that we are taught about history is from that point forward. Ancient Egypt is more recent than that, and the, you know, Greece and Rome and the Maya and the Inca and the Olmec and the Toltec and all of these things are more recent. So I looked at that picture, at that chart on the board, and I said, okay, you're telling us about what happened to the right of the point of Sumeria, what happened to the left? I said, what was here before that? And I remember he laughed at me. He said, son, don't waste your time on that. There's nothing out there. He said, nothing happened before that. And what I'll say is nothing could be further from the truth, because our own science now, and I've personally documented some of these, but I'm just going to share peer-reviewed archaeological evidence now, excuse me, is showing us that our civilization, we have been steeped in a story about civilization that began 5,000 years ago. And we're told that's the whole history of all civilization. And now what we know is that is only the history of the most recent 5,000-year cycle of civilization. And there was another one before that. And this is where the archaeology is right now. I spent a lot of time in Peru. There's a site 4 hours north of Lima, Peru, called Corral.
Yes.
And we're told that civilization began 5,000 years ago. Corral ended 5,000 years ago.
Yes, fabulous place.
Before that, and if we want to just cut to the chase, I mean, there's so many we could go through, and I know you do with other guests, but if you cut to the chase, right now the oldest technologically advanced civilization that's being acknowledged in mainstream science is Göbekli Tepe, which is in Turkey on the border near Syria. It's a very difficult time because of the war right now. But this site is now archaeologists agree that the depth that it has been excavated is right around 12,000 years before present, mm-hmm. which is right at the end of the last ice age. And as they go deeper, now they're pushing that date back into 13,000 years plus
right.
before today, which puts it into the last ice age. So now we're talking about, and these aren't little hunting communities with little huts and campfires. These are technologically advanced civilizations. They have architecture, they have agriculture, they have mathematics, they have a form of writing that we're only beginning to understand. Mm-hmm. And in Göbekli Tepe, the sites, interestingly, were all buried intentionally.
Isn't that a fascinating subject? Yes.
Well, and we don't know why, but what it did is it preserved everything so well. Mm-hmm. And so now the date that we are teaching our young people in the classrooms today is now more than twice as old is what we have been led to believe. But they're not sharing that in the mainstream texts or the classroom. So mm-hmm. the answer is cycles are involved. And interestingly, 5,000 years ago, as a geologist, I can tell you this, was the last time our planet went through a cycle of climate change, very similar to what we're going through now, that forced mm-hmm. people to live differently, forced them to live in different locations. Their food was grown differently. And interestingly enough, 5,000 years ago, as the first evidence of large-scale war and conflict among humans prior to that time, in the cycles prior to that time, there is a lack of evidence. We don't find the evidence of weapons or walls built to preserve and protect communities and temple sites. We don't find them there. 5,000 years ago, Sumeria is the first time armies faced off against armies that we see in the archaeological record. And the thinking is, among the archaeologists now, mainstream archaeologists, is that the shift in climate forced people into making a choice between cooperation or competition. And at that time, they chose competition and conflict. And we are now the product of that. And here we are going through the same cycle again. And the question is, what will we choose this time around? And mm-hmm. we are making that choice today in our lifetime.
Do you think that's because of? Do you think it's because of the materialistic focus could have been the issue after the 5,000 years? If you just were to make a guess at it, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because I want to get into the book, but just...
Well, this is all important. It actually lays the foundation mm-hmm. for what we're going to talk about in the book, so it's okay. And it's, you know, there's so many different perspectives that we can go about here. The point is that the people of the world, we are steeped in a story mm-hmm. That began about 150 years ago based on Darwin's ideas that competition and conflict is the natural order, that nature is based upon survival of the strongest. And even though that was 150 years ago, that happens to be about the same time that our society was being developed, that our economic system was put into place, corporate systems were put into place. So we are living the consequences of that thinking, and it's breaking down. It's not working because it is unsustainable. It's based on something that's not true. So this is why I call this a precious turning point in our time in history, because now we know what does not work, and we have the science to tell us what nature truly is based upon. If we want to create systems that are harmonious and sustainable, we know how to do that now. It's based on cooperation and what's called mutual aid. The question is, will we accept that? Will we embrace that? Or are we going to follow the same path that we followed 5,000 years ago, the last time we went through one of these cycles? Mm-hmm. So different weapons, different kinds of war, but the same principles. The weather's changing, climate's changing, where we live, what we do for a living, where industries thrive, where we grow our food. All those things are changing now. We simply have more technologically advanced ways to either work successfully or to impose our will upon others as we go through this time of extremes. And that's why when we talk about the extremes, I think we cannot separate what's happening in the big world from what's happening in our everyday lives. And even the skeptics that used to argue against that, within the last few weeks, we've seen a ripple go through the economic system of the world that affected everyone. All of a sudden, people's 401ks and their ability to save for retirement, put their children through school and their plans for their future and their the jobs that they rely upon, you know, week to week, month to month, all of that was impacted by this economic ripple. And mm-hmm. it is only a ripple. It continues to this day. And they're saying, what in the world is going on? And how do we deal with this? Mm-hmm. So we can't necessarily change the big things in the world. What we can do is we can develop within ourselves the most extraordinary capabilities that have been with us all along, that in large part there's a reluctance to talk about them in the West. And those capabilities, not only do they make us healthier people and trigger longevity, but they also help us to become more resilient to change. And that was the reason I wrote this book, with the specific techniques that help us to do these things. And then, so this is part of the answer to your question.
Mm-hmm.
While the techniques are based in science, the way that we apply them are precisely what I have learned in spending time with some of our most ancient and cherished indigenous and spiritual traditions. They didn't know the science, but they knew how to embrace these states, how to trigger these extraordinary states of awareness in our bodies that help us to deal with change in a healthy way. So It all comes together in a really beautiful way.
Let's talk about one of these extremes. In your book, you say, arguably the greatest crisis that we face in our time of extremes is a crisis of thinking. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is we've just touched upon that briefly. There is a thinking, and it's not just in America or just in the West. I've seen this all over the world. In the last 5 years, I've been on every continent of the Earth except Antarctica. I haven't been there yet. I'd love to go. But what I've seen is there's a thinking that there was a time in our recent past where everything was kind of chugging along pretty well. You know, we had our ups and downs, but everything seemed to work. Everything was all right. And then something happened. And for some people, that something was 9/11. For other people, it was the economic collapse in 2008. But regardless of what it is they believe had changed, here's the thinking, that we are now living this little anomaly. They're saying we're living this anomalous time, and if we can hold on long enough and just wait for things to get back to normal, then everything's going to be okay. And that, I think, is let me just tell a quick story. That's the best way to illustrate this.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and I, we live in a very rural area in northern New Mexico that has been especially hard hit, the double whammy, both economically and through climate change. The rains aren't coming. People can't grow the crops and sustain the cattle the way they have for the last 300 years. So they're selling their farms. They're having to move, find new ways of making a living. My wife and I took a drive up through northern New Mexico into southern Colorado on a really beautiful autumn day just to look at the trees turning and go through some of these little mining communities. And we stopped at a convenience store for gas. And I went inside, and as I paid the cashier, I asked the woman, how are things in your community? And she looked at me. This is a very quick story. She said, when the mines are open, she said, life is good. They said people make good money, they feel secure, they send their kids to college, they have bigger families, they build new homes, they build new businesses.
Mm-hmm.
She said, when the mines close, life is hell. Everything comes to a stop. And I said, that's got to be really tough. I said, what does everybody do when the mines are closed? She said, they do whatever they can to hang on and wait for things to get back to normal, for those mines to open, for things to get back to normal. They stop sending their kids to school, they stop having bigger families, new businesses, all of that. And I said, wow. I said, well, how long have the mines been closed this time around? And she said, right now, she said, these mines have been closed for 9 years.
Hmm.
9 years, this community put their lives on hold. And it looks like it. It's a tired community. The buildings are run down. Businesses are closed. And I got back into our truck, and I said to my wife, I said, I think I've just witnessed in this little community a microcosm of what so many people throughout the world are feeling.
Hmm.
And that is, they are waiting for the world to get back to normal.
Hmm.
And the reason that's important is because there's a lot of good news coming with our time of extremes. And one of the things I love to say to our audiences is that we already have all the solutions to all the big problems, the technological solutions. We've got more food than we need to feed every human that is hungry for the next 50 years. The UN tells us food security is not a problem right now. We have the technology to create clean, green, sustainable electricity with zero greenhouse gases We've had it for 60 years. We already have these things. We already know how to build sustainable economies. We know how to build resilient communities. But the question is, how can we embrace all of those good things that allow us to thrive if we are clinging to an idea of what the world used to be and what things should look like?
Yeah.
If we're clinging to that emotionally and psychologically, there's no room to allow these beautiful new things that help us to thrive into our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the reason that I shared that story. I share it in the book. And I see it all over the world. The thinking is, if we can just fix the climate, or if we can just fix the debt, everything's going to go back to normal, when the truth is the world that they're waiting to go back to, it no longer exists. There is no normal to go back to. We are living a new normal for our lifetimes and for our children's lifetimes. We're living a time we're going to see volatile economies.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see volatile climate. And the way, how can we become resilient to those things and embrace them in a healthy way if we're not honest about what we're dealing with? So mm-hmm. that's the reason it's important to acknowledge these things.
Do we need to look at the some of the metaphysical or even other ways of reality creation and think that, look, we create our own reality, and we just need to think a new reality or be more positive in this new reality unfolds itself? I mean, that's hard for a lot of people to conceptualize, but I think it's been proven in the laboratories that, your thoughts can actually create and manifest different things. What do you think about that?
Well, it all ties together. We cannot separate one thing from another. For me, I am all about, I am an optimist, and I'm also a realist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a scientist. And what I know is that if we are real, if we keep it real about what's happening here, we're all going to be okay. We've been through this as civilizations before. If we know where to look into our past,
mm-hmm.
this is, I think, the value of looking into our past. What worked for our ancestors and what didn't? What can we learn from them? And the things that didn't work that we're doing today, we can stop doing them. Let's stop putting our energy in the things that don't work and the things that do work. Let's do a lot of that. And what we know is community is key, that cooperation is the key, and that's based on rock-solid science.
Mm-hmm.
Now, however that plays out on a metaphysical level, that's up to us as individuals. We can do these things in our own lives. We can do them in our families. We can do them in our communities. We can do them between nations. But they all fall within this context, this fundamental paradigm. We are steeped in this story of us and our relationship to the world that's based in separation. We've been told for 150 years we're separate from our bodies and largely powerless over our bodies when it comes to healing. That we are separate from the world and largely powerless, that we have very little influence over what happens in the world around us, that we live in a linear civilization that began once 5,000 years ago, and here we are at the pinnacle. So there's nothing to look back to, and we've been taught that nature is based in this fundamental rule of competition and conflict. Every one of those is now peer-reviewed science is telling us every one of those is categorically a false assumption. Every one of them. So as we embrace the new discoveries that we live in a world that's deeply connected, we're connected to our bodies, we're connected to the world, civilization is cyclic, nature is based upon the model of cooperation, what's happening now, and this is all happening within the same window of time, the conditions of the cycles are driving us to look for new ways to live because the old ways are unsustainable and they're collapsing. At the same time, the best science of our time parallels our most ancient and cherished spiritual traditions. So if we can get past the language and look at what they're saying, what the science is telling us, the connectivity, the cooperation, that's what many of our ancestors told us about, and that's what they used when they went through the last cycle. So it's not like we're lost. What's happening is we are now being asked to think differently, and I think it is perhaps the greatest crisis. If we're trying to solve the problems that we find today through the thinking that led to the problems, it makes no sense at all. And that's precisely what we're asking our young people to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a resistance to sharing these new discoveries in the classrooms, in the textbooks. So now we're asking an entire generation of young people to solve the problems. We lead for them with the same thinking that created the problems. It makes very little sense. And when we begin exploring those indigenous traditions, this is where the spiritual principles, what some people call as metaphysical principles, the line between science and metaphysics gets really blurry. Mm-hmm. When we begin exploring these, because of the discoveries of new science, the quantum physics that tells us we are deeply connected to the world, and the new biology that tells us thoughts, feelings, emotions, and beliefs that are taught in our spiritual traditions, they actually change the chemistry in our bodies. And when we create the right conditions, and we think and feel very specific kinds of thoughts and feelings and emotions, we actually unlock the medicine cabinet that lives within all of us for healings that sound miraculous. And it's all based upon the way we think of ourselves and our relationship to the world. So all of a sudden, that boundary between what we call science and spirituality gets even fuzzier than it has been in the past. Mm-hmm. And it happens to be an area that I specialize in, that I'm fascinated by. Because I believe we owe it to ourselves, Cliff, to honor ourselves with all of the information that's available so that we have the evolutionary edge to not just survive, but literally transcend, to become better people, to build stronger communities, stronger nations, and a healthy planet from this time, rather than just trying to survive and get through a tough time. It's a very different way of thinking. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are hunkered down in survival mode. That's a very different way of thinking than embracing all of the new opportunities and what we now know about ourselves and our world so that we can thrive. And the change is the trigger. It's the catalyst that's forcing us to look for new ways to think and answer our questions. So, again, it brings us back to why I wrote this book about resilience from the heart, because on a personal level, the change we're talking about actually begins with how we relate to our own bodies, and it begins within the human heart. Mm-hmm. So that, again, was a long answer to a short question, but all of these things, we're tying them all together, hopefully, in a way that makes sense.
Can you give an example of thinking differently? I know that for me, I have been meditating for over 20 years, and I find that helps me clear my mind, and I think in some cases it's not been proved scientifically, but I think it actually opens a different gateway for creativity and for new thought to come in for me. But do you have any examples of thinking differently that our audience can kind of go, well, that makes sense, or whatever?
I can give a perfect example, and this is one of those places, Cliff. Every one of us learns differently, mm-hmm. and every one of us thinks differently, and this is why there is no one solution for everyone. And for some people, meditation works really well. For some people, prayer works really well. I have a personal yoga practice I've practiced for 40 years now, every day of my life. It's one of the most consistent things. It's lasted longer than careers and relationships in my life. So there's a whole different interview that we can do around that. But,
right.
Some people don't relate to these things in the way that we're talking about. And it doesn't mean they're not part of the solution. It doesn't mean that they're left out of the process. Because we all are conditioned by our families, our communities, our religions, our spiritual traditions, our friends, to think and solve our problems differently. So I'm going to give a really quick story. I've already mentioned we live in northern New Mexico, and it was especially hard hit through both climate and the economies. A friend of mine, his name is Ken, and that actually is his name. It's not a pseudonym. Was a builder of really high-end, beautiful, clean, green, sustainable homes all through the desert Southwest, and he'd done it for over 30 years. And he'd just taken on the biggest project of his career, an entire community. He was asked to build an entire community of these clean, green, sustainable homes. Hmm. And he was very excited. The problem was it was the year 2008. Not only did the economy collapse, but the housing market collapsed, and all of a sudden, everything he dreamed of and he'd worked for in this project fell through. And he had no way to support himself. He had a crew of workers, about 30 people that relied upon him. He couldn't support them. He lost everything. In the old way of thinking, this is a perfect example, in the old way of thinking, where we believe we live in a world of competition, when something like this would happen, we would try to recreate somewhere else in the world what we had done successfully in the past. That's just the way we've been taught to think. And Ken did the same thing. He looked for other places. Where could he go build these clean, green, sustainable homes? The housing market collapsed. Nobody needed the homes then. And he was really struggling. And when he tells this story, he does it so beautifully. He said it was from a deep sleep. He bolted upright in his bed from a deep sleep. And obviously he was having some kind of a dream. And as he woke up from that dream, he was asking himself a question. And this is why I'm sharing this with our listeners. He didn't say, how can I fix everything or how can I do what I've done in the past? He said, what do people need right now? So what does my family need? What does my community need? And he woke up the next morning and he began to build the answer to that question. He said, people need to care for themselves. They need to provide for themselves with food, for example. Food that they know is safe, that's abundant, that is inexpensive. And he began to design and build an innovative system of raised bed, self-watering, self-heating, covered greenhouses that would sustain food 12 months out of the year, no matter how hot or how cold. They were as small as 12 inches square for a high rise in New York where people have no land, or as big as 4 feet by 8 feet square, and you could string two or three of them together here in the Southwest where we've got more land. And Ken is thriving in this new business. He's hired more people than he ever had in the past. He's healthier. He loves his job. He loves getting up in the morning, helping people to do what he's done, what he's doing right now. And all he did was he changed the question. And this is what's important. It ties back to just a few minutes ago in this conversation. If we lived in the world based upon false assumptions of competition and conflict, it would make sense to ask ourselves the question, what can I get when I make this choice or this decision in my life? What can I get from this relationship? Or if I take this job, what can I get? We don't live in that world. And it's showing up big time in our lives. What we live in is a world based in cooperation and mutual aid. That means that fundamental question has to change. And Ken is a beautiful example of that. He changed the question from what can I get from the world that exists to the new question, what can I give? What can I share? What can I contribute? What can I offer to the world that's emerging? And in doing that, he aligned himself in harmony with the fundamental law of nature, of cooperation, knowing that if he contributed his gifts in the way that he knew how to do, that not only would his community benefit, but he would benefit as well. And that is a huge fundamental shift in the way we were conditioned to think. Rather than asking, what can I get? Ask, what can I give? How can I contribute? And I do this, I have to tell you, I do this many times every day when I'm asked to work on projects, I'm asked to collaborate, when I'm faced with a situation that is maybe a struggle for me. I'll step back, take a breath, and I'll say, how can I contribute? What can I give? What can I offer in this situation? And the way I answer that question, Cliff, opens up a vast array of new possibilities and helps me to adapt to the situation. That is a form of resilience that wouldn't have been available if I were in it only for me. What can I get for me? What's in this for me? So that is, along with meditation, along with, you know, all of the personal practices we've learned, when we're faced with a changing world and a shifting paradigm, and we've got to make these decisions, if we can do so aligned with the fundamental rules of nature, now we find ourselves in harmony with nature, and nature's harmony is all about cooperation and mutual aid. Ken's story is a perfect example, concrete example of how every one of us can do it starting right now.
That is a great example. It really is. Can you give us one technique or a suggested technique that can kind of open members of our audience here to some of that new thought or intuition, whatever you want to call it? Because while you were giving this example of your friend and his revelation for a new project, I was thinking of the millions and millions of people that have to get up every day, 9-to-5 existences, who are bogged down with having to pay bills, having to take care of their life and their family and make a living, and they just don't have the wherewithal to make that jump. Is there little bits of movements or suggestions that someone can go, okay, I can try that, and all of a sudden it might open them to something like that experience?
First of all, what we just did is one of those things, and also, I know a lot of our listeners, people, every audience I go to, every community that I connect with through the World Wide Web, there are people who are either losing jobs right now because the world is changing and what they've done in the past doesn't fit the way it did in the past. They're either losing jobs or they're not losing jobs. Cliff, this is really interesting, but they're feeling like they need to do something different.
Exactly.
And they don't want to be stuck.
Right.
And either way, what I've just suggested, because what Ken did, it wasn't based on a degree that he had or any certificate or anything he had ever done in the past. And that's the beauty. Whatever your passion, I'm speaking directly to our listeners, whatever your passion is in life, that's the gift that you can most effectively contribute to your community, to the world. And when nature, when the universe taps you on the shoulder and you feel that urge to create, to do something different, to do something new and innovative, whether it's art, whether it is music, whatever it is, technologically, whatever it is, that is universe saying, we need this from you right now. And that's your opportunity to say, how can I contribute? And then your left brain has to find a way to do it in a smart way. Mm-hmm. And that's what Ken did. He took all of his skills as a businessman, but he channeled those skills as a business person into something he had never done before. So I think this is very practical for all of us. But before we leave today, we referenced this new book a number of times. What I want to say is this. The book, the most recent book, Resilience from the Heart, all the change we're talking about, for us to adapt to that change physiologically, emotionally, psychologically, we have to be prepared within our bodies. There's a new discovery that rocked the world, the medical community, and especially doctors associated with the human heart. In 1991, in the journal Neurocardiology, is where this discovery was actually shared for the first time. And it was the discovery of about 40,000 specialized cells in the human heart that hadn't been recognized in the past. They are cells, they're called sensory neurites, very similar to brain cells, except they're in the heart. And the way they are situated in the heart is a neural network in the heart. They are concentrated in such a way that scientists actually call it the little brain in the heart. And this was a surprise. We've been doing heart transplants since the 60s. They've been relatively successful. Scientists said, you know, we pretty much have the heart nailed. We know pretty much everything there is to know about the heart. How could we have missed this? And what they missed is the fact that these 40,000 sensory neurites, they have the ability to work independently of the brain in our head. So the little brain in our heart literally can think independently of the brain in the head. It can remember independently of the brain in the head. It can feel. It can sense. So there is one path in the book where we talk about what this means in terms of our personal lives and the extraordinary capabilities that simply this discovery opens the door for. But what perhaps is even more astonishing is not only can the heart work independently of the cranial brain, but when we learn specific techniques, we are able to marry this neural network in our heart with the neural network of the human brain, two separate organs. We marry them into a single neural network, and now we've opened the door to these truly extraordinary states of human experience that sound mystical, that are referenced in many of our spiritual traditions. But science is now telling us they're only extraordinary until we learn how to create them in our everyday lives. Then they become an ordinary part of our lives. So what am I talking about here? We're talking about linking the heart and the brain, these two neural networks, into a common neural network that allows us extraordinary states of deep intuition on demand. We've all had spontaneous intuition where we pick up the phone to call someone and they're already there. because they were going to call us and say, oh, isn't that interesting, you know, a coincidence how that happened. Mm-hmm. But it's spontaneous. And if you try to recreate that again, probably isn't going to happen. Or when we suddenly, when we're not thinking, when we're in the shower, our eyes are closed, we're alone under that water or sitting at a stoplight, staring off into space, and all of a sudden this insight comes to us and we've got all the answers to the deepest mysteries in the universe, and then the light turns green and we forget all of them. those are spontaneous. Yeah. Yeah. What we now know, and these techniques allow us to do those kinds of things when we choose, at will, on demand. When we connect the heart and the brain, it opens us to a hotline to the subconscious mind. And if we're going to change unhealthy patterns of self-esteem and the way we think of ourselves that are creating unhealthy relationships in our jobs and our careers and our marriages and our families, this is the way to do that. It's the same technique. The same technique opens up the door to what we would typically call things like ESP or precognition in the laboratory. It's very, very clear that we know when things are going to happen. Emotionally significant events can be known before they actually occur. There's a whole program, you know, that we could do on that. Hooking this heart and the brain together, it also triggers powerful states, over 1,300 biochemical reactions, healthy biochemical reactions, including the triggering the anti-aging hormones in our bodies. Now, who doesn't want that? And powerfully enhanced immune systems, who doesn't want that? And this brings us back to the beginning of our conversation, it is the connection of this heart and the brain that actually creates greater resilience in our heart and in our lives so that we can embrace big change quickly in a healthy way. Hmm. Embrace big change quickly in a healthy way. So simply connecting this heart-brain system, this complex, these two separate organs through a common neural network, gives us the ability for all of these things. And what's so interesting is the techniques to make that connection that were demonstrated in the laboratory, these are the techniques that have been preserved in our most ancient and cherished spiritual traditions. Mm-hmm. And they all begin with the emotions in the human heart and how we link those emotions to our mind. So in the book, we lay all of this down in the first couple of chapters with actual techniques of how we go about doing this in the laboratory and how they parallel those in our indigenous traditions that we talked about earlier. So I know that's a lot of information in a short period of time, and I just didn't want our time to go by. Everything we talked about in this conversation provides the framework. It is the context within which change is occurring. And now we know that we have the ability to not just survive, but to embrace that change so that we're better people and create better communities, better, stronger families, stronger societies, and to do it in a really healthy way. And that's why I wrote this book, Resilience from the Heart.
Greg, I really enjoyed our conversation. Again, the book is Resilience from the Heart, The Power to Thrive in Life's Extremes. And, we could talk forever today and in the future about this book. So your website has all your upcoming events. It's www.gregbraden.com. For those of you living on the West Coast in San Francisco, Greg will be at the New Living Expo this coming spring, and I will talk about it again. We'll have him on just before he appears at that event. But Greg, you're constantly doing events. Seems like every weekend you're somewhere.
Well, we're on the road probably 2 weeks out of every 4 weeks in the month. And our website, our publisher hosts a beautiful website for us, and they have all of my events up through the end of 2016, actually, are on that website right now. And a lot of the things we're talking about, I will be talking about in San Francisco. It's a very visual program, and I'm going to focus on some of the ancient civilizations. The Smithsonian Institute is giving us permission to share some of those images with live audiences. We cannot record it for film, but I can share it with live audiences. And what we found in those monasteries in Tibet and in Bolivia and Peru, the libraries that are there, and it's a very fast-moving, very visual program. And I understand that the expo this year is at a new location, new venue. Mm-hmm. I've spoken at the expo in the past, but never in this new venue. So this will be the first time, and I'm looking forward to being in a new venue with all of our all of our friends and family in the Bay Area.
Yeah, fantastic. And again, we'll talk more about it as that date comes up next year. Greg, a pleasure, and I look forward to connecting you with you again in the future.
Cliff, thank you so very much. I want to say it's been an honor and really a pleasure, as I sensed our time would go by quickly. And I don't have to have a new book to have a conversation with you. So I'd love to pick up where we left off today at another time, okay?
Sounds great. Appreciate
it. Thanks so much. Take good care.
You too. Bye-bye.
So that was Greg Braden. I hope you got something out of that. You know, a lot of the speakers that I have, a lot of the authors, guests that I have on my show talk about ancient history, but they don't really put it in context towards what we're dealing with today. And I think Greg is a great spokesperson and somebody who can actually translate some of that information. We get it from our wisdom keepers, which are usually Native Americans who are able to express themselves and tell us about their traditions. But having somebody who is educated from a university, but who sees things from a wisdom point of view, ancient wisdom, ancient tradition, and then spins it and can mix it with some science. And by the way, I hope you heard that he doesn't follow a lot of the current theory. He believes a lot of it is not correct. And you can read about that in his book, Resilience from the Heart, The Power to Thrive in Life's Extremes. I suggest you do a search on Google, go to YouTube. He's got there's a ton of lectures he's done over the last, I'd say 10 years. Just pick one and listen to him. There's some short 15, 20 minute videos that might interest you. So that's today's program. Next week, my guest is Marshall Carfield, who actually has been on the circuit quite a bit. He tours around the country, and he's written a lot of books about giants, and I thought he was interesting. He also touches quite a bit about on Nephilim. And, of course, the big panel discussion kicking off Sitchin's new book, The Anunnaki Chronicles, is October 17th. Now, I'm not going to divulge who the panelists are, but there are four noted authors considered experts in the field of giants. And again, they're all published authors, and they will be joining me in a live discussion on ancient giants around the world, Saturday, October 17th. So be sure to look forward to that. All right. I hope you have a great day, and we'll talk to you again.